Welcome to the Index Podcast, hosted by Alex Kahaya. Plug in as we explore new frontiers with Web3 and the decentralized future.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Index, where we talk with the entrepreneurs, builders, and investors who are building the future of the internet. We do this because we believe that people are worth knowing. And for us, we want to tell the stories of the people who are pushing the internet towards a better future. This covers everything from artificial intelligence to blockchain technology to augmented reality and virtual reality and more. And today, I'm excited to welcome Todd Wiesel, CEO of Baxis, a secure and innovative marketplace for trading wine and spirits. Baxis grants users access to a wide array of bottles from around the world, enabling them to exchange collections with a community of enthusiasts who share similar interests. I'm now an investor in Baxis as of this morning. So just a disclaimer there. I'm really excited to have you on the show, Todd. And you know, obviously super bullish on what you guys are trying to build. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
I am excited about Baxis for a number of reasons. I really like whiskey and scotch, and I have experienced firsthand some of the problems that you guys solve. And I know other people who collect whiskeys who have those similar problems. But before we dive into like the specifics of Baxis and what you do, maybe you could just introduce yourself and give people kind of your backstory and how you got to doing this. And specifically, I want you to think about, you know, why is what you're working on important? Why is it important to you? Why are you here?
My journey that led me to Baxis and really launching this is long and circuitous. When I was around 21, almost 22 years old, I finished my service in the Israeli military, came back to the United States, and a friend of mine was like, hey, you're a big guy, you just finished military service. Do you want to work as a bouncer at a whiskey event I'm working on? And I'm like, sure, why not? And at that time, I mean, my knowledge of whiskey was like, you know, different colors of Johnny Walker meant better and worse. And so I went to this event and I was expecting college party. And what I found was this really refined group of individuals who were coming together and meeting with these vendors and talking to them in depth about the spirits they were producing. And when I first got there, I'm like, oh, this is all marketing, right? It's all the same stuff, just in different color, you know, different packaging and better marketing. And as I was walking around the event, I ended up running around being more of like a staff hand, helping out with the other vendors who were there, you know, pouring whiskey. I started to listen to the conversations and I realized there's a lot more to this. There's a lot more to this than just packaging and marketing. There's really, you know, spirits in particular and wine are where art meets science. A lot of it is done obviously scientifically with the actual chemistry, but so much of it is done out of just the experience and the passion of the people who are producing it. And so that kind of got me hooked. I went home that night and the vendors tipped us with the open bottles. So I'm like 22 years old and I have like a 30 bottle whiskey collection overnight, which was pretty cool. And that kind of led me down the rabbit hole. I was hooked. I needed to know everything I could about the bottles that I had in my house, about the bottles that people were tasting at the event, about why people love certain brands but not others, what made them unique, what made them different, you know, what was different between scotch and between bourbon and between Japanese whiskey. And I kind of got hooked on it. And then I discovered that it was a really expensive hobby. Collecting whiskey can get definitely pricey. So I started to learn a little bit more about the trading of whiskey, where people would, you know, buy a bottle or two in New York that wasn't available in California and trade it to someone over there or, you know, someone in London or really all over the world. And I started to learn about the inefficiency of alcohol distribution and in particular how, you know, the laws really came into effect after Prohibition in the United States and haven't really been updated since. So we're working, you know, a century or so behind right now. And from there, I went and I transitioned. I went to work at Dalkeith Brokerage, which is one of the larger cask brokerages in the world. So they actually work with distilleries and with private producers who, you know, who are selling their barrels of whiskey, you know, selling them to the market, whether it's to brands who are buying whiskey from distilleries that don't have their own brand. In the UK, we call them independent bottlers. In the US, they're called NDPs or non-distilling producers. I love those guys. And then from there, we kind of got into the fine and rare bottles, not just casks, but there started to be a lot of demand for people who wanted to buy, you know, rare collectible bottles of whiskey or offer them to clients. And so I ended up heading up that initiative and really leading the fine and rare bottle division, which led me to launch my own whiskey fund, in which we traded, you know, bottles and casks for with the experience I gained over there. And then COVID hit. And two things happened. One, whiskey prices, like almost all other, you know, assets and collectibles, absolutely skyrocketed. Tons of new people flooded into the market that wanted whiskey and wanted spirits and wine. But the shipping lane shut down. So the actual distribution and shipping and sending and, you know, actually transmitting the bottles became even more inefficient than it was already. And it was pretty inefficient to begin with. You know, when you pack up a bottle of alcohol, there's all that risk of glass breaking, you know, it not being handled properly by the package handlers. If it's very old, it could leak. And so for wine, you know, the temperature and conditions that it shipped in. So there's a lot of little factors that really added to the complication. And then on top of it, when you look at it, you've got the actual environmental cost of packing up bottles and shipping them all the way around the world over and over again, just because somebody wants to prove that they own it. So that really kind of led to the inspiration for Baxis was how do I make it so that people everywhere around the world can get access to buying and selling and trading the bottles and the casks of wines and spirits that they want and that they love, whether they want them as collectibles or whether they want them to eventually drink or to sell on. But giving it to them with kind of that proof of ownership, that ability to prove that they own it, even if it's not sitting in their house.
Talk a little bit more about that. Dig into the technology you're building. You use blockchain technology under the hood, but my understanding is like users don't really need to know anything about crypto or the blockchain, you know, infrastructure. Why do you think this is all important? Why does it need to be on chain? And talk a little bit more about how the product works.
Sure. So there's a couple of reasons that we kicked it off on chain. And this was, you know, 2021 when my co-founder Carrie and I started to really work on this. And we were looking into blockchain on the back end of just the actual transaction database. And the idea of that was one of the biggest issues is in this space is both provenance and transparency of pricing. These are very, very opaque markets, which makes it really difficult for people to get involved in. And so we started to look at database management and realized if we were to put these assets on chain, you're able to actually track, you know, ownership, provenance, you know, link them to the bottles. So we do that, you know, we attach after each bottle comes into our vault, it undergoes a 360-degree scan. So you can see, you know, super high resolution, the actual details of the specific bottle that you're purchasing or that you have listed. And then on top of it, we actually attach an RFID that links to the token address and to the actual bottle itself on chain. In May of 2021, when we started to dig into the building a little bit more, was kind of really that explosion in the NFT market. And so we started to get this understanding of instead of just building a totally, totally Web2 front end with kind of blockchain in the background just to record things, this is actually a really perfect use case for NFT technology, for the idea of a singular, you know, non-divisible, non-fungible token that represents one of one ownership. And while all of the attention at the very beginning was on, you know, profile pictures and JPEGs, we realized that the underlying technology there actually could be the cornerstone of building a new version of internet commerce. So that was really important to us. But at the same time, what was really important was the vast majority of the collectors in the wine and spirit space are not, I don't want to say they're not all technologically savvy, but there are definitely, you know, there's a disconnect between some of the newer technologies and a lot of the skepticism about, you know, blockchain or crypto or things like that. And so for us, we wanted to make this as comfortable and familiar to these people, regardless of whether they were, you know, again, familiar with the underlying technology as they were with going onto a Web2 marketplace and buying something or trading something. So, you know, kind of taking what they're doing with Robinhood for stocks or StockX, you know, for sneakers with that same type of commerce flow that you have from Amazon for buying, you know, anything.
I know you got this question a lot during the raise. Why do these assets need to be on real world assets? RWAs is like the short acronym that you'll see on Twitter. And I got this question too when I was talking to people about Baxis, like why do we need this on chain? What is the benefit of having this? You mentioned one, which is like for your business, like tracking the price of the bottle associating with the physical item. That's like interesting, but what's the real value unlock that comes from having an asset on chain like this?
So there's a couple of really, really big highlights. And the first one that I always touch upon is interoperability. And that means that once your bottle or your cask, your barrel of whiskey is now minted on chain, verified that it's in custody of Baxis and is in your account, you are now able to do anything you want with that asset. If you want to go play a game of online poker and use that as your buy-in and somebody's willing to recognize the value, which again is published because it's all visible and transparent on chain, you can go and use that as your buy-in. If you want to go and use it as collateral for a loan, you can go to any of the DeFi lending protocols. You know, they'll list off the tokens that are in there. We actually have a partnership with an app called BridgeSplit, which does exactly this. And people will actually be able to borrow money against their collections, which is something that is not accessible to the vast majority of people. Only the absolutely wealthiest of people are able to go to their banks and borrow money against their wine collections or their spirits collections. But that's another part of it, is just giving the kind of that element to it. So that interoperability with other protocols and with other things that are emerging is one important thing. But the other super, super important part, as I mentioned about provenance, is this ability for all of these assets now to live in perpetuity, for that proof of ownership to now be able to be taken with you anywhere that you go. So if you need access to immediate liquidity, you have the ability to actually sell that asset right now with that trustless state. I don't need to know who the seller on the other side is, because the bottle is held inside of a Bax's vault. It's been authenticated. I have this 360-degree scan. So if there's a tear on the label, that's really apparent to me. I can see exactly what it is that I'm buying. And now you're able to scale this to a global scale. Instead of it being people who can only check out if they live in New York or, you know, New Jersey or Colorado or the US, you now have buyers on our platform that are from Australia, Hong Kong, the UK, Europe, all over the world, that are able to tap into this. Again, with that global public transparent database to see what these are actually trading for. Because unfortunately, with most opaque markets, which includes a lot of RWAs, there's a lot of side dealings and a lot of things. You know, one of the benefits in the real estate market is that after the sales become public, so that information gets published, so you can go on and look up how much a property sold for. But when it comes to wines and spirits, that doesn't really exist. So imagine trying to trade real estate where you had to know the individual seller or buyer to actually find out what the actual closing price was. That's how wines and spirits are trading now. And ultimately, that ends up, you know, harming the ability to scale that market on a global level.
I want to touch on the first one you said and then lean into the second one a little bit more. But the first one was about interoperability, right? And when I was talking to you about this, the way you described it is like a composable API, right? And the thing that I brought to the table is that it's permissionless on top of that. So to break this down for people who might not be that technical, like an API stands for application programming interface, and it enables a developer to connect to an application and build things on top of it. So like Facebook has an API, X has an API. Most applications you use have an API that then developers can build value-added services on top. This idea of a permissionless API, that is what blockchain databases enable. I hadn't really thought of that until, you know, we had this conversation about Vaxis. And I think it's a really interesting thing to understand and like lean into. The fact that the network effects you get from having a platform as a service, you just can get out of the box if you start putting assets on chain. You don't have to do any extra development work. You just get the APIs essentially without having to build that yourself as an entrepreneur and as a company. It enables people to gain a ton of value from the assets you're putting on chain through just anybody who decides they want to build something useful, whether it's a poker game or whether it's Baxis making lending possible for anybody who wants to get a loan collateralizing their wine and spirits. So I think that is something that is really powerful. I'm still kind of like digging into it and digesting that idea in my head, but I think as a general thesis, it's a pretty strong one. What you guys are doing by creating this liquidity, to your point too, is you're actually making the market a lot bigger, right? Like the global market for whiskey collecting now is much, much bigger because of this permissionless ability to buy and sell whiskey, but also to compose that those assets into more useful things outside of that. So what I would love to understand is like talk a little bit more about, you know, you've got a lot of experience working in like the Web2 version of this world. How are they getting liquidity on like a cask, like someone who's making a cask producer? How are they doing that before Vaxis exists? And then now what can they do?
So, and again, thanks. You summed it up perfectly with the APIs and the permissionlessness is exactly that. Is, you know, if somebody wants to build a whiskey auction, they can recruit the assets directly from the Baxis vault and from the users. If they want to build, you know, an SEC compliant fractionalization protocol, they have the vault and all the assets built in with the pricing data directly for them. So yeah, so one of our big things is really working with producers as well. It's not just the private owners of the collections, but actual distilleries, wineries, etc. And there's a couple of ways that we're helping them access kind of that more liquid capital markets. So traditionally, starting a distillery can be really expensive, which is why a lot of brands start off as non-distillery producers, as I mentioned, the NDPs, and they'll actually buy whiskey in bulk from, you know, a massive distillery and then bottle it under their own label and use the proceeds of that to try and, you know, fundraise or save enough money up till they can build their own distillery. And so there's two fronts of that market. One, they need the capital to go and buy those barrels, you know, that they're using to launch their brand. And part of the issue is getting those barrels financed without having a transparent market, without having an understanding for potential investors and lenders as to what the value of those barrels is on the open market, what the value of the whiskey inside the barrels is once it's bottled, makes it really difficult to get capital to those brands. And the same thing applies to the new distilleries that are starting. So often what distilleries end up doing is they'll sell off, you know, most or a massive amount of their production of their earliest whiskeys when they're getting started to investors at, you know, at cost effectively to these large private equity groups, effectively at the cost of production. And then they have to buy them back, you know, whether they want to release a bourbon at 4 years old or 6 years old or 8 years old, whatever the age that they're releasing it at is, they now have to go and buy it back at 50 to 100% margins, you know, and annualized returns. So if they sell the barrel for $1,000 in year one, they might be paying $3,000 or $4,000 to buy it back between years 4 and 6. And that obviously ends up hurting their numbers, because in the US, there isn't direct to consumer sales from distilleries. So it then has to still go through the 3-tier process, which I won't get super into, but basically distilleries sell it to a distributor who sells it to a liquor store who sells it to a consumer. And everyone is tacking on a markup. So the distillery, which puts in all the money and the effort and takes on that risk, ultimately is seeing the smallest piece of the pie at the end of the day. And so what we're enabling them to do now is to say, instead of going and, you know, selling effectively this production en masse, why don't you borrow the money against the value of the production? Because lenders now have the ability to A, access a liquid market for these barrels. So in the event that there's a default on a loan, they don't have to go and now find a buyer. They can immediately list them on the marketplace. They're able to immediately go and basically put these up for sale. And they're, because the loans, you know, in their earliest stages now are at roughly 50% LTV, there's so much upside for the lender in that case to actually, you know, make sure that they're made whole. So they have basically eliminated most of the risk on the loan side. And on the borrower side, yeah, they're getting at a roughly 50% LTV, but they're paying, you know, 12 to 15% interest instead of effectively 50 to 100%. And so it gives them a lot more upside, and it gives them a lot more profit in their product as well, which helps them grow and expand faster. So working with these smaller brands and smaller distilleries to help them get off the ground ultimately leads to, you know, more product, more unique and diverse product, because each distillery really is doing something a little bit differently, whether it's a different style of still or a different type of whiskey that they're producing or a different yeast strain. There's all these little nuances that go into it. And that ultimately, you know, benefits the consumers. We get a wider variety of things that we're able to choose from.
For real world assets in general, where do you see this going in like 5 years?
There's a lot of focus and discussion on real world assets around like putting real estate on chain and some of these other types of technologies, or even putting, you know, equities on chain. And while I do see the value of it, I'm not as bullish on those areas, because when those are all things that by law require permissions, they require, you know, stop gaps, they require, you know, approvals and KYCs. And obviously there's a lot of protocols being built on chain that will enable that. But I haven't held a physical stock certificate in my hand, maybe ever. So when I think about going into my, you know, stock brokerage account, it's already digital to me, even if it's not on chain and doesn't give me that same interoperability. So the one massive benefit I could see is the ability to, let's say, borrow money against your equities from anyone in the same way that we have, you know, what we were discussing with these APIs. But what I really see the RWA narrative and things shifting to in two ways. One of them is aggregator platforms that'll basically come on top and start to do really curated listings for assets that are stored in vaults like Baxis. There are other companies that are doing this for sneakers and for watches. And, you know, as someone who loves both watches and sneakers, you know, when I go onto StockX, one of the biggest issues is I'll buy a pair of sneakers and it could take a week and a half, 2 weeks to get to me. And then if I decide, okay, I don't like the way they look, I don't like the way they fit, I have to then list it again. And that next buyer, it's taking them that same week and a half to 2 weeks, because I have to ship it back to StockX. They have to re-authenticate it, then they have to ship it back out. And so you end up slowing down the velocity of trading. And what we see with all types of efficient markets is that the faster you're able to actually give people, you know, the ability to conduct commerce, the more commerce that gets conducted. So what I really think that we're going to start seeing is a lot of traditional collectibles being moved into this new kind of vaulting kind of infrastructure, where they'll actually go into, you know, private vaults, get scanned. And then especially as we look into the future of kind of AR and VR and what's happening in like that, you know, the metaverse space, one of the biggest issues right now is like, okay, so you can prove that you own your PFP, let's say, right? You know, you own your whatever it is that your JPEG is when you're in this metaverse or in this AR, VR. But if you're building out an interactive space, like the ability to actually have assets on display that you can prove you own because they're in a vault is super, super cool and has a tremendous amount of value. So like somebody could have a kind of metaverse AR, VR based watch store where all of these different watches that are owned by private people that are, you know, held in vaults around the world and have been scanned and tokenized, you can now walk into somebody else who does the curation and go and say, okay, let me, you know, flip down my Apple, goggles, Google, whoever it is that has those at that time. And you'll be able to see what the watch looks like on your wrist. And you'll be able to say, okay, I'm buying this. You'll see the pricing history. You'll see the provenance and the ownership. So, and luxury auctions already looking for new ways to transport it because there's tremendous amounts of risk. Again, if you're trying to move some 5th century vase between countries, the cost of actually packing it up, shipping it, making sure that it, you know, transfers entirely safely, the insurance costs associated. So all of those types of commerce are going to be able to be simplified by storing things at points of origin. Same thing for, like, you know, when we were talking before a little bit environmentally, like if there are things that are being produced and only purchased as collectibles, not having to ship them all around the world for global distribution where you're trying to guess where your target market is rather than having them listed directly to your target audience is going to really, really expand and decrease the environmental impact of it. And lastly, it's what I really, really think we're going to start to see a lot more of is kind of the financialization of these elements. We're going to start to see, you know, derivatives and compliant derivatives built on top of it. So you'll have, you know, links. People will start to do correlations between, you know, game-worn sneakers by NBA players and their basketball cards and their signatures on random pieces of paper on basketballs. You're going to start to see a lot more of that and that interoperable trading as well. So you'll start getting people who are massive, you know, there's a lot of overlap between whiskey collectors and wine collectors and classic cars and watches. So you'll start seeing transactions that'll take place where, you know, somebody swaps a Ferrari for a couple of bottles of whiskey that are worth, you know, same or similar based on that type of pricing, which again, ends up meaning more global trade and more users and more opportunity for a lot more people to make good money, even passively through, again, finding these kind of, you know, barn finds and all these interesting things that would normally just go sit in an antique shop or at a pawn shop can now actually have access to a global liquidity because the guy lending you the money, you know, that pawn, so to speak, is not some pawnbroker. It's actually somebody who really wants your asset. So if you default on the loan, they're happy to actually take the underlying asset instead of have to worry about now they have to go and sell it.
One thing that keeps running through my head is like this vault. How does that work? Security has got to be a concern. Is it like a warehouse? Like, I don't want you to give away all of the secrets, but like, well, how does this vault work? It's a physical place.
It is a physical place. Yeah. So we don't use a warehouse for a bunch of reasons. They're too large in some ways and have a lot more points of failure, potential points of failure for security. So this is something that we've been really digging into when we set up our vaults. We are pretty specific how we do them. Again, I won't get too specific, but there's a ton of security. So we're talking like, you need multiple key card entrances and approvals to be able to get through the various doors that, you know, and get to the floors that you need to go to access it. Once you get to the vault, there's, you know, thumbprint and other types of scans and codes and passwords that need to be generated, you know, in order to get in. Once even inside that first chamber, there's like multiple layers within the vault itself that you need to go through with different keys, you know, kind of like a little nuclear submarine-y kind of style. And so that really is one of the things, because security is of the utmost concern. And, you know, fortunately, one of the big things is having come out of this industry, we knew how to set them up, you know, both from a security perspective, but also from a safety perspective. But also we knew who to go to for the proper insurance. So like all of our vaults are fully insured, you know, for the value of the bottle. So in the event that something would happen, the owners have that peace of mind that they're still, you know, the value of their collections is still safe. But ultimately, that's going to be definitely something as we continue to grow and expand. That's really important to us is making sure that we have that same level of quality and security for, you know, because we're holding on to people's, you know, prized possessions.
Yeah, really interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that market develops because there's definitely like a system that you can repeat across markets. And I guess that's my next question is like for Baxis, like is whiskey the end all be all or do you guys have plans for other markets? Do you have any in mind like, or is that like too far off to really even bring up?
So this is something that we love to discuss all the time. The analogy that we always give is Amazon started with books. That's obviously not what Amazon is today, but it's really important to us that we absolutely nail and really dominate that initial market. You know, if Amazon had said, oh, okay, we're going to do books, and then 3 weeks later, we're selling a million other things, they wouldn't have built up that traction and that type of people wouldn't have relied on them as much for what it was that they were doing. And so wine and spirits, because of the complexities, because of the fact that we find that the capital markets for there are less efficient than almost any other type of luxury goods and assets that we're looking at right now, or even collectibles. And there are fewer markets because of, again, regulatory and legal issues that, you know, anyone can sell a baseball card on eBay, but go try and sell a bottle of whiskey on eBay, you're going to get shut down right away. So it's much harder for people to access those, you know, those user bases and those other traders and collectors. So that's really our core area of focus. But the technology that we've rolled out in the vaults that verifies that the assets are there, we use helium sensors to actually measure the temperature and humidity and the conditions inside of the vaults. Same thing that we're rolling out now for distilleries to be able to measure remotely the climate conditions inside of their warehouses to track their barrels, as well as like the locations of them. All of that technology is 100% horizontally scalable. We can do it with, you know, again, if somebody wanted to send watches, diamonds, gold, bars, random, you know, ancient coins, those are all things that could be done, but it's really not our primary focus right now. But the technology and the infrastructure is there in order for it to be turned on immediately. So in the future, it might be, you know, Baxis provides it as a service where we literally roll out the vault and the technology for someone who wants to build the ancient coin online, you know, Web3 marketplace. It might be for someone who wants to do it for art or for photography. But right now, this is our core focus is really on, you know, I won't just say whiskey, but wines and spirits in general. So we're looking right now much more to go, I think, vertically into the wines and spirits industry. There's a lot of inefficiencies that can and will be solved through, you know, more transparent blockchain-based technologies that Baxis is building. But because of we spent a lot of time and thought building out our infrastructure before we launched, we've situated ourselves in such a way that we easily can start to expand in that horizontal way. Like I said, where Amazon didn't immediately get into publishing their own books, they started to sell other things before they did that. So we're really in a position to kind of expand both vertically and horizontally.
My second to last question here has to do with like the thing you brought about eBay, right? Like, so you get shut down if you try to trade whiskey there. I'm assuming that's a regulatory thing or a policy thing. And then, you know, I saw some news about there's some like trade war stuff going on between the US and the UK. My thinking on that is that Baxis makes that better for consumers because you don't have to deal with that because you're not actually shipping it yet. How are you able to do what you do inside of this like regulated environment? Is there some loophole or like how does that work?
So we won't give away the entirety of the secret sauce, but yeah, it has a lot to do with like licensure. That the US, when you look at liquor laws in the US, it's actually 52 sets of individual laws because you have federal laws about drinking ages, et cetera. But then you have each state and Washington, D.C. have their own laws about trading, selling, shipping. So it's basically a series of, you know, getting the proper liquor licenses, getting the proper partnerships and making sure that we're compliant within that three-tier system I was describing is kind of how we're able to do it. There are back-end intermediary processes that take place that the users don't experience or interact with at all that actually covers that compliance and gives that peer-to-peer trading feeling, even though there's actually, like I said, stuff happening on the back end that makes sure that it's proper within the regulatory framework. And that's one of the interesting things with eBay in general is that only applies to eBay in the US. Like eBay in Germany does a tremendous amount of alcohol volume. People are actually able to, you know, buy and sell and trade on eBay in Germany and in the EU. So that's a big part of it as well, is kind of, you know, expanding that global operation and market so that people can trade now in Germany with people in the US as easy as they can with other people in Germany. And you mentioned the trade wars, which is definitely something that comes up a lot. Because exactly that, these are always, they have to do with tariffs, you know, import, export. I believe it's right now the EU is about to put like a 50% import tariff on US produced spirits. So the cost of bourbon in, you know, France is going to go up massively. And so these ultimately do have an impact on people in multiple fronts. One of them is obviously from consumption. Although, again, if you're shipping a bottle from our vault into France, you're still going to end up going through, you know, those tariffs over there if you're actually importing it. But what it does enable is for people who are buying these bottles because they want to collect them or they say, hey, you know what, I'm going to be in New York for NFT NYC. And so I'm happy to buy this bottle while I'm in Paris and then come and pick it up or drink it when I'm in New York. Like it gives them the ability to kind of have that proof of ownership and that to access those assets without having to physically connect with them, take delivery of them, be present. So that is definitely a really big element to it. And yeah, I mean, when the US and the UK were having their trade wars and, you know, the price of the cost of importing scotch, you know, skyrocketed, especially single malt scotch skyrocketed. That was a big thing that I did was, you know, I was lucky enough to have friends in the industry that lived in the UK that could purchase the bottles. You know, I could purchase the bottles I wanted and have it kept there until they got rid of the tariffs, and then I could have them shipped and imported in. So,
yeah, and that's literally what people are going to do. They can just buy them and ship them later.
Exactly. When these things normalize, or again, each country is different, but you know, you're allowed to take a certain amount in duty free for your own personal consumption, or even if you declare the duties, they're pretty cheap. So you can buy them, and then next time you're over there for a trip, pick them up and bring them back. So it's a lot of ways that are going to help, again, on that individual commerce level. It's not about the, hey, we're trying to disrupt the, you know, mass importation of bourbon into France. Like, that's not, you know, we're not serving the drinking market in that capacity, as far as the, I want this in my liquor store, in my bar. But for the finer, rarer, more collectible, tradable bottles, that's definitely a big consideration and solution, is like just making them, again, by not having them travel, you've eliminated risk of damage. You've eliminated a lot of costs associated with import and export laws. And again, we always like to just reference and look back as like, there's just a massive environmental impact savings by not packing bottles into plastic and styrofoam and shipping them 50 times before they finally end up in the house of the person who actually is the end consumer.
We're getting to the top of the show here, and my listeners will know I always ask the same question at the end of the show. But what have I not asked you that I should have asked?
Well, I would say, I think about how we're, you know, because our user base, like we said, the initial user base that we're going after is not the crypto folks. So I think a big part of what we're doing now, we announced about a month or two ago, an acquisition of an app called Booze App. And that was super exciting for us. I followed and knew the Booze App founders since they launched, and have just been amazed with what they've built. And what they basically built was the perfect complement to Baxis, which was a way to keep track of all of the prices, like what's fair market value. You know, totally, when you think about the ethos of cryptos, it's like user generated, like users voting on what they think the fair market value of a bottle is. How much would they be willing to pay in a liquor store to buy this bottle? Along with the national average for MSRP and the national average for shelf price. So when you go into your liquor store and we just recently are adding a new feature now for barcode scanning, but you scan the barcode of a bottle and it's on the shelf for $59.99, you could see if that's actually fair, if you're actually paying a fair market value. And then if you decide to buy it, you can immediately add it to track it at your at-home bar. You can add it to your wish list. So it's basically like the one-stop shop for people who are, you know, whiskey and spirits enthusiasts, to keep track of what they own at home. As you can see, I've got a bit of an extensive bar behind me over here. And so keeping track of what I actually have, what I drank, recording my notes, like, did I like this? Should I be buying this again? Did someone come over and love it? So if I decide I want to buy them a gift, I know to get them that bottle. Like, making kind of that personal database, you know, that friend that you can always rely on to check, hey, did I like this last time, or did I pay a fair price for it? So that really, really fits into Baxis, because, you know, bringing you over from there, they have over 100,000 users. Those are all active participants in the whiskey and spirits markets. But also importantly, they're willing to and able now to contribute data that ends up helping the collective. You're going to end up with a lot more crowdsourced data and information about where people can find things, what the prices are being listed for, which, again, helps the producers, helps the consumers, helps the entire vertical. And then from there, we're really now thinking a lot about of how do we provide education to the crypto blockchain community, to the people who are not at all familiar with wines and spirits as an asset, as something that's a collectible, as something that retains value fairly well, is, you know, substantially less volatile than plenty of other things in the market. So that's something that we're definitely working towards also, is finding the right, you know, Web3 and blockchain companies that we can partner with to help educate people. Because one of the things that, you know, I like to say is that there's an inherent, you know, if we're thinking in NFT talk, there's an inherent floor price for bottles, because there is a value at which somebody is willing to buy it just to drink it. You know, there are certain, I'm not saying that the most expensive price it ever traded for is the actual value or the floor, but, you know, if somebody wants to sell me a Pappy Van Winkle 23-year-old and it drops to $2,000, like, I will buy that all day, because on the open market right now, they're trading at, you know, somewhere between $4,000 and $7,000, depending on the, you know, efficiencies or inefficiencies of your local market. So that's something that I think people would be exciting to explain to them, is that there's an inherent intrinsic value to the underlying good. It's not a purely speculative asset. And in that last point, they're naturally deflationary. And I love to say this, but what I mean by that is, you know, when you produce a single barrel or even a small batch or even a large batch of something, there's a finite supply that is produced for that vintage, for that release. And so every time you get together with your friends and you open a bottle and that bottle gets finished, or you go to a bar and there's an open bottle, that means that there's one less in the circulating supply. And so you're going to continuously have the actual supply of these things dwindling. And when you get, you know, a bottle that's absolutely out of this world and it gets a cult following and there's 1,000 people who want it, but only 103 that were ever made, and now there's only 45 left, like, that ends up having that impact on price that people, you know, that's what they dream of when they think about NFTs is, oh, wouldn't it be great if the supply could keep shrinking and we could keep growing demand? And it's like, well, yeah, just buy wine and whiskey.
Yeah, I never even thought about that with Baxis, but it seems obvious when you say it, but it does kind of align with one of the things I've been looking for and why I was excited about what you guys are building, or one of the reasons is like, this is a market where people are already actively collecting, where the technology creates a unique opportunity and unique value for the customer, and that didn't exist before. That's exciting.
Yeah. It keeps us up at night, but it also gets us up in the morning.
Yep. Well, hey, thanks so much for being on the show. Really enjoyed having you. Where can people find you? How can they participate? Like, what's the call to action here for anybody that happens to be listening?
For sure. Yeah. So first things I would tell everyone is sign up on www.baxus.co. It's baxus.co. Sign up for your account. Take a look around on the marketplace. Get a sense of, you know, what we're doing over there and how we're building this out and how we're really helping to scale access to this market on a global basis. And I would say, you know, follow us on Twitter. We always post really cool things that we're doing, whether it's partnerships or auctions or collabs with other brands. So that's at baxusco, B-A-X-U-S-C-O on Twitter. And if anyone wants to bug me personally, you know, about whiskey, about blockchain, about any of these things, I am on Twitter also at web4o. So that's web4 and the letter O. I wasn't special enough to get a four-letter Twitter handle, and we like to say that we're very much so ahead of the curve.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
Amazing. Thanks so much for having me.
You just heard the Index Podcast with your host, Alex Kahaya. If you enjoyed this episode, please give the show a 5-star rating and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your favorite streaming platform. New episodes available every other Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in.